This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, we're flying solo again. How are you today?
Good. Yeah, Jen's taking care of dogs today. So that means you and I rate below the dogs. Just in case you wanted to know, we got that clear. That's how you find out where you stand. But no, that's all good.
Yeah, who takes precedence over the podcast?
You got it. All good. All right. Well, how about yourself? You doing well?
Doing great. Some listeners may know, I just got an ACL surgery. I tore my ACL playing ice hockey, and as much as I wanted to avoid it, that seemed like the only move. So I'm just recovering now. I get to sit and do a lot of podcast stuff, and then I should be back playing hockey in very soon. So,
cool. All good. All right. What do we got today?
All right. Good. That's enough small talk. All right. So, dear doctors, yeah. I'm a 35-year-old female, and I don't know what to do with my life. I have a bachelor's degree in biochemistry, a doctorate degree in pharmacy. I've worked as a clinical pharmacist for a year, but then I got bored and I quit. Then I worked as a massage therapist, a real estate agent, and a dental hygienist. I got bored of those as well. They just didn't satisfy me, even though I don't even know what I'm looking for or what I want. My personal relationships are the same as my careers, casual at best with many different men. I really want to settle down in a career and relationship, but I just seem unable to do so. What should I do?
You know, this question is so out there that it's even hard to believe that it's true. It's like somebody's like playing a joke on us. Those are no small careers. It's no small thing to diligently seek a undergraduate degree in biochemistry. That is no small thing to do. It's no small thing after that. It's even a bigger thing to go after and get a doctor of pharmacology. To be a massage therapist is no joke, although for somebody who has a doctorate in pharmacology, they already know a bunch probably about anatomy, so the hassle of the massage therapy degree isn't any big thing. Then switching all the way over to become a real estate agent, it's a completely different, not that it's at all difficult for a person of this intelligence, but it's such a different domain of life. So that's odd. And then there was something else she did. What was the other thing?
Real estate. And then also, what was it? Dental hygienist.
Dental hygiene.
Yeah.
That's also no small thing. Dental hygienist has to go through schooling and so forth to do that. So first things first is that I don't believe that any 35-year-old has done all these things. Okay. So I consider this to be an entertaining theoretical question. And anybody diligent enough to do all these things, then we're also throwing in a caricature of, I just have a bunch of casual relationships with men, can't seem to settle down. It's like, is this even possible? This is a very bizarre human. This would be one of the most unusual personalities I have ever seen, if this is true. Now, if it is true, all we're looking at is a bizarre juxtaposition with respect to a bunch of funny-looking things, a funny-looking profile on the Big Five. So we're looking at very high conscientiousness, or you could never, you know, you can't be anything other than high conscientiousness to get a degree in biochemistry, a degree in pharmacology, become a dental hygienist, And I'm forgetting one of the things she did, massage there, like whatever.
Real estate. Yeah.
Okay. This is real estate. I mean, the conscientiousness to follow through, pass all these exams, you know, obviously the big ones are the undergrad degree and the grad degree, but it's no small thing to become a dental hygienist. That takes incredible conscientiousness in, you know, I met one that was a flake, but that's because she got addicted to some kind of speed or something. But the truth is most dental hygienists are extremely conscientious, which is not inconsistent with this woman's other major degrees. So we've got very high conscientiousness, but apparently we are so open that we can't ever settle down, and it would be the openness that would be driving the boredom to feel like, hey, I'm not learning anything. And essentially the way to think about openness is to think about an animal out in the middle of a habitat that animal, if it's a human, it's looking at some rolling hills and some mountains in the far distance, and it has a very good set of circumstances, perhaps where it is, a little river and a little community there and good friends, but it's thinking, you know what, I want to go see what's on the other side of that big mountain range. And it's a long ways off, you know what I mean? It's 110 miles out there. But I've heard stories about it, and I cannot not do it. Okay, that would be the openness. And so, i.e., even though we've got great circumstances, they're boring. Don't want to do it. I feel like there's too much to learn. I'm leaving too much on the table. This is all derivative of the fact that what animal brains are is that they are, it's a computer full of resource acquisition algorithms. And so the algorithms are going to be decision-making strategies for taking in sensory information, lining them up against memory information. Memory information might be direct sensory information that you had before of a real-life experience, or it could be the sensory memory of someone telling you that over on the other side of the river, there's some really cool shit. That's also your memory. It's just that you're getting a report from somebody else's brain about their sensory experience. But in any event, we have memory data and direct sensory data that is being crunched in essentially the central processing unit, or what I call the universal value system calculator, that is effectively the mechanism by which your brain is going to decide what to do. And therefore, it's going to drive the feelings that you have. It's going to dictate the motivational process and the direction of your behavior. So you can imagine that this universal values calculator, and obviously it's going to be extraordinarily different from species to species. So it'll be quite, you know, it'll be somewhat similar in a chimpanzee and a human, but there will be very, very significant differences. There'll be a lot of similarities, okay? But if we go from a human to a, you know, a swordfish, it's going to be dramatically different because the overall architecture of the body of the animal is so different that it is required to be very, very different as different threats and opportunities in its habitat. And therefore, the architecture of its motivational system, the nature of how its brain is going to work, is going to be quite a bit different than the way a human brain is going to work. There will be similarities. They will be pleasure-seeking, pain avoidance, energy conservation principles that will be at the root of its design. It will probably use dopamine and possibly endorphins as essentially reward chemicals. So there will be a lot of similarities, but we will see that the differences of the values of different environmental circumstances will be dramatically different between the swordfish and the human, but not so dramatically different between the chimpanzee and the human. That's because of the degree of the DNA that is being shared. So 98% of the DNA in a human and a chimpanzee is identical. Now, what gets interesting here is that when we look about the difference between species is akin or exactly analogous. It's just a difference in terms of its quantitative variation, not qualitative, between as the same thing as between personalities and humans. So two human beings that have exceptionally similar DNA are going to have a great deal of the same preferences. They're going to have the values calculator, will be very similar. Now, it's going to be 99% similar between any two people. It's going to be, what do we mean by that? The DNA is going to be shared 99%. So we're going to find that they have extraordinary similarity in what it is that they find to be beautiful, what they find to be tasty, what they find to feel like is dangerous, etc. That's why so many people can go to the movies and have a very similar psychological experience and value it similarly, and then they all get high ratings on, you know, whatever it is, you know. Yeah, okay. So it makes sense to us when other people have very similar reactions to us to the very same stimuli. Sometimes it's confusing and disturbing when they don't. Okay? Like a mother fixes her kids some tamales and the kid's like, "No, I don't like this." And it's like, "What the hell do you mean you don't like it?" Mom takes a bite right in front of the kid, brat or whatever, and says, "Hey, it's really good." Okay? Now, so the thing is that the final 1% is where it is that you're going to see, from our perspective, sometimes striking differences in individual preferences, i.e. one person loves NFL football, the other person loves roses. And so this is going to be the root of that difference is going to be the vast majority of those differences are going to be laid at the door of DNA. And so this person has the DNA that says, "I've got to go over the other side of that mountain range. And if there's another one on the other side of that mountain range, I'm going to have to go to the other side of that mountain range." That's very, very high openness. Okay. Now, it is possible to have very, very high openness as well as have very high conscientiousness, i.e. Sir Edmund Hillary. That's how the hell you get to be the first man to get to the top of Everest. Okay. You better have incredible conscientiousness as well as the very high openness. If you put those two things together, you can get some funny looking human beings. Okay. This is a funny looking human being. And so she's like, "Well, when can I ever settle down with one guy and settle down in a career?" Good frickin' luck. Okay. You are looking at your genetic code as it searches the landscape looking for the next better deal. The high openness is effectively optimism. It's the optimism that is telling the organism it's worth the risk, okay? Now, it's actually statistically not worth the risk. That's why the gene pool is dominated by people that are in the center of that bell curve. No, it's not worth going all the way to those big mountains. It's worth going over to the next little hill, getting on top of that hill and convincing yourself that it's really no better on the other side of the other hill than it is on this side of the hill. And therefore, we're going to come back home and we're going to say, "Hey, we've seen enough of the landscape. I don't think that we can reasonably improve our circumstances by X amount of risk and effort. And therefore, we're going to stay right here in, you know, whatever, wherever it was that Jimmy Stewart didn't leave, you know what I mean, in It's a Wonderful Life." I forget what it's called, Smallsville or whatever it was, okay? So the So that's what this person is dealing with, is she's watching her life as she has a restlessness that says, "I believe that there's likely a greater prize on the other side of the next hill." Now, the truth is that she doesn't have a choice about that inference. That inference is embedded in her DNA. In principle, we understand that the mind is running these kinds of risks and decisions against the clock. It knows about how long it's going to live. Okay? So it has to. It doesn't make any sense. You couldn't have an organism run a cost-benefit analysis on any set of circumstances in its life if it didn't have an estimator as to how many choices and dilemmas and opportunities it was likely to get. Wouldn't make any sense. You couldn't build an algorithm for the decision-making of an animal unless it had an estimating system already embedded in it. Okay? Now, so this person, according to, I'm just trying to think this thing through, with respect to the genetic code, she's done perfectly reasonable things. She's had, you know, multiple partners. She would have had multiple children by now, which would have changed the arc of her behavior quite substantially. Okay. So we're now looking at a human who has cut the cord on actually what all the romancing and sex and different partners was all about, which was to have three or four different children by three or four different men. That's a different mating strategy than a girl who's a little bit more of a monogamous pair bonder and would have had three or four children by one guy. But there's no in principle reason why this particular strategy isn't an okay strategy. It's just not a common strategy. So that's that. There's nothing really bizarre too much about that other than it's kind of unusual. But then we can see the reason for the unusual is, in fact, the high degree of openness that's inside the system. So it doesn't surprise us. It's going to show up somewhere. It would show up in mate selection. Okay, so it's also showing up in, after I've gone to a hell of a lot of investment in a farm D, it's like, nah, forget it. 1 year, I'm done. That brain is suspecting a brain of that caliber and an openness of that caliber and a conscientiousness of that caliber and emotional stability of that caliber. That individual has accomplished a lot of difficult things that require a lot of emotional stability. That individual is an extraordinarily unusual individual, and it knows that it is capable of bigger things. Okay, and so that's why she's searching. And the openness is driving her. There's got to be a more spectacular mate out there, someone that would actually somehow suffice her. There's got to be a career challenge, something she's designed by nature to use her time and energy optimally to bring the most that she can to the village in order to get access to the most resources for survival and reproductive problems of her own. So if she feels like that brain and personality are being underutilized in any of her current previous circumstances, the restlessness continues until she feels like she's met a challenge that is, you know, going to take the best that's within her to achieve it. So she hasn't found it yet. That's fine. If this is a true human, this is a very interesting dilemma, but it means that you don't really have a choice. There's no way to change you. You have to continue to, and you're not being constrained the way a similar ancestor would have been constrained by finance. You know, a girl in 1820 couldn't do what you're doing, even if she could be educated, at some progressive university at the time. She wouldn't have the resources to continue to educate herself in different ways. She would not be able to experience multiple men without pregnancy. In other words, this life and wouldn't have been possible in the Stone Age to actualize so much different potential with respect to marketing problems. You'd have to specialize in digging potatoes, and that would have been that. So you get an open people live fascinating potential lives if they've got the intelligence and resources and emotional stability and conscientiousness to continue to achieve, a la Elon Musk. Okay, so what the heck? It's an adventure. Wishing that it wasn't going to be Mr. Toad's Wild Ride isn't going to change anything. So I have no prescription for you other than to, you know, follow your dreams and your imagination, both in mating and in career. And sooner or later, the biological clock constraint that sits inside your nervous system will eventually close down your openness at some point, and you'll settle down in all probability. All right.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. I appreciate that. Sure. I remember meeting somebody when I was training at True North who was a very accomplished lawyer and decided that it was a bit boring and she wanted to go to medical school just to change it up a little bit. And I remember talking to her about it, and it was just similar kind of mentality, although I don't know, like you said, this is a lot of things to do by 35.
Yes, this is a lot of very diverse things to do by 35.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. Yeah. All right.
On
we go.
Our next question. Dear doctors, the euthanasia law recently changes. The euthanasia law in Canada now has changed to include mental illness as a valid reason. Seems deeply disturbing to me based on an evolutionary psychology perspective for people in the majority of situations. This would have been considered a slippery slope argument on euthanasia in the past. I can't see how they are considered logical fallacies anymore at this point. What is your libertarian perspective on this issue, given your wealth of knowledge within these areas? It reminds me of the suicide booth on a particular cartoon called Futurama, which is beyond satire. Is this truly progress?
I haven't thought a lot about this topic, so I would have to reserve the right to have somebody correct me with considerations that I haven't thought through. My first reaction to this is to feel like that there should be, that it would be absurd to me for the state to be weighing in on such a decision. The job of the state should be to essentially stop people from forcing each other to do anything. So the state's job, from a libertarian perspective, is that the state should not be involved in human affairs. That the entire purpose of a free society is to elevate the individual above the collective. So that would mean that if I feel like killing myself or hiring somebody to kill me, that's my problem. The problem here gets tricky, because what if the person murders me and says, hey, they hired me to do it, they signed right here. Okay? So that's not an insurmountable legal problem. So now we have a panel of people that we sign documents in front of, and so we have a whole panel and it's videotaped or whatever and it's notarized. So now we can see that these people, this group, didn't actually murder me. I actually did this voluntarily. Okay? That would seem to me a perfectly reasonable thing. I just can't see that the state is here to serve the people. The people are not here to bow to the state, unless you're talking about some modern takeover of Western democracies and totalitarian dictatorships around the world. Then we have a little different perspective on things. If we are the people in the cabal in Davos, Switzerland. Now, for people thinking, you know, stepping back and saying, well, now wait a second, what if I were in a situation that I absolutely wanted my life to be gone, but I actually didn't want to have the grisly process of putting a gun in my mouth and pulling the trigger? I don't want to do that. And I also don't want to be responsible for trying to figure out how I'm going to try to do this humanely, because I have no experience at it. And how much am I going to inject? And, you know, what if there's some drug reaction problem? What happens then? In other words, et cetera. So why in principle wouldn't I be able to contract this out if this is what I wanted to do? Okay. And again, just because it's a strange looking contract, it's not really all that different than saying, hey, I'm going to go under an operation. You know, I'm going to be out for 6 hours. And the doc says, well, I want you to sign this thing that while I'm in there, I can take your gallbladder out, you know, if I need to, or, you know, if it looks like I should. It's like, no, don't slip that in the fine print, doc. I can delineate, you know, likely contingencies that may come up that I want to constrain their behavior. So I give them limited license to do this or that. So that same kind of process, and by the way, these legal documents and thinking along the lines of problematic contracts like this, they have to go through an evolutionary process or a cultural evolutionary process where it's tricky that, you know, mistake by mistake and confusing thing by confusing thing, this is like watching the rules changes in the National Football League. It's like, well, no, now that's not legal, because then the guys would, you know, cause the fumble to go forward and they'd throw it out of bounds in front of them if they're getting tackled to get to the first down. So then they had to make the rule that, no, you can't advance a fumble. Okay, now that changes that.
It's like watching Twitter improve.
Yeah, exactly, okay. So the thing is that this would be, you know, this is a new kind of thing for human beings to be considering. This is where, you know, this is where having a sort of deep understanding of what the state ought to be and what it shouldn't be, and then actually having representatives, and we can vote on those representatives. But I can see a representative democracy voting for individuals that would say, listen, I think you own your own body, for God's sakes. And if you want to end your life, it's nobody else's business. It's not, I mean, I think it's true in many states, or maybe the United States in general, something, it's like illegal to kill yourself. It's like, you've got to be kidding me. How on earth is that illegal, for God's sakes? It's your own life. So the question now becomes, okay, this is going to wind up with some thorny questions about this. You know, the last thing we want is, you know, my ex-wife, you know, after I, you know, before I could get a hold of my will, you know, she had me commandeered by a group, and then they put me in a mental facility and gave me shock treatment, and then I signed a document that said I wanted to kill myself. It's like, okay, we can come up with all kinds of nightmare scenarios that would have to be what? Very, very intelligently thought through, and have legal checks and balances on such an incredibly dramatic contract, to have that be very, very carefully written and understood and double-checked and triple-checked, et cetera, et cetera. So I could see, I could see, for example, that it would become the standard of practice that, you know, the courts or the law could potentially come down and say, okay, if you ask for this to be done, it cannot be done for at least 90 days or 120 days or whatever it is, and that there has to be a panel of five independent people and blah, blah, blah. So we can, you know, we can draw that up and think it through and learn as we go. But the notion that this should not be possible because it disturbs people, that other people would choose to take their life, to me, holds no weight to me. Other people want to have sex with people that you wouldn't like them to have sex with, i.e. two males having sex or two females having sex, you know, the et cetera, or a very old lady and a very young man, or vice versa, that might disturb people's sensibilities and they want to have a law about it. No, I don't think so. I think everybody gets to do what they want, unless you are forcibly interfering on other people's rights to do the same for themselves. And so taking your own life or contracting with somebody else to take your life is not forcibly interfering with anybody else's right to do what they want to do with their life. And so they should not have the right to forcibly interfere on you when you want to do something with your life. So that's how I would come down on that. At least, like I said, I would be open to all of the discussions about the infinite complexities that could arise logistically. Those are legitimate questions that some of they would have to be voted on, you know, by representative government. We would have to have some ground rules. We could, in principle, have a country or a state that would say it's not going to be legal in this place to do this. Fine. If we have a representative government that says that we're going to take away that right of citizens to make those exchanges, there's nothing we can do about that. That's the limits of the freedom that people are willing to give themselves. Okay, but unless explicitly removed from one's freedom, it should not be removed by anything other than what is ultimately a majority rule. And so anyway, that's how I come down on that.
Okay. So
all right.
Probably be a caveat in there. If people are on some sort of psychiatric medications that cause them to feel suicidal.
Well, this is going to be part of the complicated legalistic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can imagine how sticky that starts to get, because the psychiatric people are going to say, oh, you can't do it unless you've gone on our psychiatric drugs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. It's like one thing that needs to be clear to people is there are no such thing as doctor's orders. The doctor's orders are for nurses. to do what the doctors say. Mm-hmm. They're not for you, and they're certainly not for a patient. It's been this kindly little thing, but actually there's a chilling thing behind that. Like, oh, no, doc, you have to do this. You don't have to do anything. So, there are no doctor's orders for people, for patients. So there are suggestions. And you know what? That's how they should be regarded, as suggestions. In fact, they should be regarded as one doctor's suggestion. Okay, well, I'm a doctor, and one suggestion I would have for you is this. So you can just smell the arm of the state and the pharmaceutical companies that is their sponsor starting to talk about how before people do that, they would have to go on a course of antidepressants or whatever the hell that anybody thinks. Ridiculous. So anyway, that's a issue for another day, since I don't really know anything about what's going on there. But philosophically, that is where I would come down. Yeah, if Jen ever listens to this, she might have some little angle in here I'm not thinking of. Probably would have something that I'm not thinking of. But at least on the first approximation of what is optimal for humans, the first approximation is I should be able to do whatever the hell it is that I want to do, unless I forcibly am interfering with you. And interfering with you is not having you be uncomfortable with me doing what it is that I want to do. That is not me interfering with you. You have to mind your own business. And so if I want to kill myself, or I want to have sex with a male, you know what I mean, et cetera, if I want to do weird looking things that you don't like, that's too bad. You got to turn off my channel and don't listen to me or don't look my way. Okay. And this would certainly fall under that category. If you don't own your own body, I don't know what you own. All right.
Agreed, Dr. Lyle. Thank you so much. It's getting the pitchfork out, you know?
Yeah, that's it. Okay. What else we got, Nathan?
All right. We pivot now to a bit of a more sad question. Dear doctors, my son recently became disabled. If finding yourself in good circumstances is what leads to feelings of happiness, how will I ever feel happiness again? How could I ever feel happiness for him if everything about his life is now difficult and painful? These are not good circumstances. Mm-hmm. My pain and sadness for him and his future is indescribable.
Okay, so what's happening is mood states or any feelings of any kind, whether they're sensory or they are moods. So sensory is the result of energy hitting a sensory receptor. So taste, touch, sound, any kind of tactile stimulation, etc. Those aren't just events. They are also judged by the calculus of the nervous system as to either be positive or negative to varying degrees, which means that what they have inside of them is that they are hooked into the universal values calculus that is, in fact, at the heart of what the nervous system is. The mood states are different than that. They have to do with essentially not direct sensory events per se, is that they are they could be triggered by direct sensory events, but they are they involve more complex calculus about what this means for the future, etc., and how the organism should be calculating and maneuvering with respect to a pattern of behavior out into the future to optimize gene survival. So that's what moods are. So every little shift of your mood, watching a football game, is nothing other than that. Every little shift in mood of your life, whether you're, quote, depressed, devastated, angry, tearful, jealous, happy, excited, lustful, whatever it is that you're experiencing, it's all a result of the activation of a neural circuit being chosen to be activated as a result of the universal values calculus that sits inside of your nervous system. All right. Now, so this woman's son has had a catastrophic loss of function. We would then expect that he is going to be depressed and she's going to be depressed because her genes are sitting inside of him. If the neighbor next door to me had a catastrophic loss of function. I wouldn't like to see it. And my empathy circuits for them would be would go off to some degree, but it wouldn't be catastrophic for me because my genes aren't located inside of them. If people are close to me but they're not related to me, they have catastrophic loss of function. They are essentially have been encoded in me as tribe, and so they may bring high value to my life, and now they have lost that value, and my mirror neurons that guide so much of human action are now more impacted, and therefore I've got a negative mood as a result of their loss. Their loss is my loss. Now, so in this case, it's a mother and her adult son. And so if she's a modern day woman and she's, you know, 60 years old and he's 35, then we know that she's past reproduction age herself. This may be her only child. She may have three. She may have another one that you know, is a deadbeat. She may have another one that's a star, but this one was the real superstar. What do we know? We do know that if she had seven children, of which five of them were stars, one of them was a flake, and then this one was a so-so kid that then became seriously disabled, it would be tough on her, but it would be tougher if this is her only child. Okay, if all the genes are located in one basket. Now, so let's assume it's something close to that. So it very likely is. People in America don't have a lot of children. So the children today are more precious than they were in 1950 when they were more like vermin. They're all over the place. Okay? So now we don't have that situation. So probably this child who's 35 years old, which means he was born in, you know, 1987. This is a child of a culture where in America where you don't have very many children. So he is really valuable. And now this really valuable creature is now in trouble. And sounds like he may be in a position where his life may be, you know, take a lot of energy to do very simple things, that he may be in a situation where he actually might be financially seriously compromised. He might be a significant drain on her resources, etc. He may have the lack of dignity of essentially having to consume more than he produces. That's a feeling of great dependency that people don't want to be in that position. We're in that position as children, and we get frustrated when we hit the limits, when we can't have what we want because we don't get to make those choices. And that drives the ambition of eventually making your own paycheck. And all of us that have ever done this know the exhilarating feeling of having your own money that your parents didn't give to you and that they weren't even the people that paid you. Somebody else did. Let you know that you can earn your way. You can, quote, earn a living as a young animal. That's a super fascinating and important component of your self-confidence. If he's now lost that ability, now he's going to be a dependent human and it's going to be hard for him, and he's actually also going to be in physical pain. This is a tough life. Now, what she's going through is she's going through the process of essentially absorbing or analyzing and calculating the degree and the magnitude of this loss. Now, you need to understand that the way the nervous system is designed is it's designed to make certain that when you have major losses that you need to experience a great deal of emotional pain. You need to do that because it needs to be educating you and underlining for you any of the features of the situation that resulted in that loss. You need to do some serious Monday morning quarterbacking for quite a long time and think through, what could I have done differently? How could things have happened? What didn't I foresee that resulted in this? Okay. You are doomed as a highly intelligent human being to actually have to go do a post-mortem analysis on this loss. You have to. Okay. Now, it's going to turn out that you will continue to do the post-mortem analysis on that loss until your mind has convinced itself that it has invested a sufficient amount of time and energy in the analysis that it no longer has any belief that there's anything further that's going to be learned by further analysis. So that, you know, that's a very fancy Doug Lyle way of saying time heals all wounds. Okay, so that's what that is. In other words, the reason why that's true is because sooner or later, the mind says, there's no sense in us ruminating and lamenting over the loss because we've learned everything that we can possibly learn about the analysis of what gave rise to it. We are now as well prepared as we can possibly be to face a future set of circumstances that are associated, that could be related to this process of where we lost. And we're ready. That's what it is. Okay? So your pain, the person who wrote this in, will subside. And what you'll find is that his happiness and your happiness, he will find his happiness in the changes of his circumstances and improvements that may be infinitesimally small relative to what he used to be capable of, but are improving his some circumstances in the present. So this is like, well, how could you be a little guy fisherman with a bad back on the coast of Mexico somewhere, earning earning $6 a day? How could you possibly be happy? And the answer is, oh, you're very capable of being happy. If you used to be just, you know, last year you were earning $5 a day and now you're earning $6 because you got a little better fishing pole. If you improved your abilities, your nervous system is designed by nature to signal that that is true with a rewarding shift of emotion. That's how it works. Okay. So I saw this, of course, I spent 10 years in maximum security prisons. And so in those prisons, you would see the people and their emotional life look pretty much like people on the outside. That doesn't really look any different. You don't see people walking around thinking about suicide, okay? It's not how it works. They're not actually walking around, you know, in major depression. They're not. They're human beings trying to improve their circumstances. And you will hear the following conversations, like, well, how's it going? Shitty. Why? Oh, man, my new celly is terrible. The guy stinks. You know what I mean? He's stolen my food 2 or 3 times. I confronted him. He denied it. You know, this guy's bad news, and, you know, we're not going to get into a fight or anything because I'm not going to do that, but I can't stand this guy. He's awful. Got it. Okay, what are you going to do about it? Well, I'm going to talk to the sergeant. They say that they can't move me for 30 days because of this or that rule, so I'm just going to, you know, but man, this is a tough month. And my sister, who was going to come, canceled because her kid got sick, so I'm not going to get a visit. I won't get another visit for 6 months. I'm kind of down about it. Okay, fair enough. Meet him next month. How you doing? Great. Why? Oh, man, I got rid of that other celly. It was terrible. This guy's great. This guy's a super cool guy. This is great celly. Guy's happy. Guy's happier than me. I'm sitting behind the desk, you know, thinking about the letter from the IRS that I got that's sitting on the dashboard of my car. Okay? It's like, wow, there you have it. So this is, in other words, your feelings are being judged not on a macro scale of the human circumstances writ large around the world of 7 or 8 billion humans, but literally, where are you relative to where you were an hour ago or 2 days ago or where you were a few weeks ago? What are your circumstances? Have they gone up or down? And so this young man at 35, he will have, you know, a struggling set of processes. There will be difficulties that's disappointing, but you'll find remarkably that people who have undergone big losses and have been handicapped are generally not, after a period of time, they're no more depressed than anybody else because their life is just like everybody else's in principle, i.e. seeking to improve their circumstances. And when they are realistic and put in the effort and they are successful, then they experience the moods of happiness. And when they are not successful, they experience frustration. And if they are repeatedly unsuccessful and they can't figure it out, they get depressed, but just like everybody else does. So That's what happens. In other words, we habituate to the current circumstances, and we then are only rewarded when we do things that wind up improving or affirming good circumstances, and we are penalized when we are in a lost situation. The reason why she's in misery is that he has experienced a catastrophic loss. It's not just mirror neurons. She has also lost directly gene survival probabilities in this. So this is a huge hit to her nervous system. Understood. This is a big loss. But all I can tell you is right now, you feel like, quote, all is lost, but all is not lost. He has a life ahead, and so do you, of a process of trying to do what? Improve circumstances. Okay? And his circumstances are likely to be improved substantially, and almost certainly will improve over the next year. Okay, so we are not boxed into depressing misery. So time will change things.
Dr. Lau, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
That's, all right.
All right, so let's our next question. Kind of pivoting a little bit now to... dear doctors, can you discuss adrenaline rush and the people who seek it, especially with respect to free climbers? I mean, I get the status acquisition part, but God, are they crazy?
Yeah, I think that is a, you're looking at a derivative of openness of a particular genetic stamp. So, I think most of this we're going to see in men. So we're going to see that this is mimicking high risk, high reward behavior in males. This is mimicking the kind of risks that you would take to defeat another tribe in warfare or to bring down a big game. So it's, quote, putting it all on the line and be willing to risk your body to do so. That's going to be an extremely rare characteristic in females. There just wouldn't be any genetic upside for females to have that sort of chip inside of them. But for males, you could see that there would be the wow that people would feel. You know, with all kinds of dangerous behavior. So, you know, what have we had? A couple of female race car drivers, you know, Janet Guthrie and Donica Patrick or what. It's like, that's it. Okay. You've had all kinds of other men die on the track seeking the status of doing extraordinarily dangerous things. So, yeah, I mean, that's what you're looking at. You're looking at a particular competitive and open chip inside there that is seeking the display of greatness. And they don't, it's interesting to know that you don't have to be conscious of what it is that you are actually doing and why. In other words, you don't have to have any awareness at all that the reason you're doing this is for example, for female adulation. You might recognize it, and I think they probably all do, but they will swear that, no, I do it for love of the game because they love it. But that's because the reason you love it is because in the natural history of the species, that characteristic resulted in achievements that resulted in female adulation. And so you don't have to know that there's a direct line through the genes between those two events. You can be vaguely aware of it. You can sort of know that it's true. There was a really good line in the movie Miracle, which is the story of the 1980 Olympic hockey team that beat the Russians.
Finally, a hockey reference, Dr. Lyle. Thank you so much.
Thank God, a hockey. Now that Jen's not here, we can just have free reign, okay? But this is a terrific movie, and it's the story of this extraordinary team that this bunch of college players, they did not use NHL players, and they had a college team that, you know, took the gold medal in Lake Placid. And I remember it's just really well done, really worth watching. And in one scene, these guys are, most of these guys will never reach the NHL. Two or three of them will, but most of them are not. It's a college team. It's a college all-star team, basically, put together by Herb Brooks very carefully to try to make a team that would work against the Russians. And in one scene, they're asking, hey, why are you doing this? And one of them says, I think a Ruzioni, saying, hey, just want to play a little more hockey. And they're chit, because they love hockey. And then one of them says, well, of course, we're for the girls, of course. It's like, of course, okay? But the truth is that those two things are so parallel entwined inside of the male brain. You better not just be playing the game for the female adulation, because they may never watch you. They may never hear about it. You know, it may be a bunch of effort for nothing. So there better be an intermediate level payoff, which is the love of the game. And there could be also a huge part of it is the respect that you get from other males from playing, and the esteem that you earn that way, i.e. in the village that way, knowing that it will be reflected out to the females around the campfire. But that doesn't, the whole thing is more than just specifically that, and it's certainly not consciously just directed at that. So that's, I forget. So the climbing of these guys, they are ultimately doing it to enhance survival and reproductive prospects, and it's clearly not survival prospects that are, they're doing costly signaling by sacrificing their own survival. They are, whether they live or die, the truth is they have risked their survival, and therefore probabilistically it has been costly, whether or not it actually, it's like a bet in Vegas. You may not lose your shirt, but statistically you are losing. And so so it is absolutely costly to do that. If you manage to survive, you are signaling excellent genes, and therefore, it could be made, the cost to survival is being made up in reproduction. Therefore, the female brain must consider that to be a legitimate fitness indicator, i.e. she must have a feeling of admiration and awe for people that do things like that. Guess what they do? Go look at any Indy 500 race or NASCAR, and half the people in that thing or a third of them are females. Okay, so watching the crazy nuts going around that track at 200 miles an hour. Why? Okay, fitness indicator. So that's how that works. Yeah, that's all that
wonderful,
is.
Wonderful, Dr. Lau.
All right, one more.
Okay. All right, dear doctors, I'm actually curious about how homophobic sentiment arose in humans, religions, cultures, etc. Has it always been there?
That's really good. I've never read anything about this, so I can't believe that some evolutionary thinker in the last 30 years hasn't thought this through, and they probably have, but I just have never read it. I can tell you my own sort of half-baked thinking on this. And that is that it's interesting, probably if you were to poll most men would not feel like they had any problem with two attractive females making out with each other. Okay? That's not going to bother them. Now, notice that most people are uncomfortable at seeing two people of any kind who are unattractive making out with each other. They don't like that. Okay? So, but they're fascinated and interested when they see two attractive people making out with each other. No, that's a good thing. We put that on the screen and pay those people $25 million to do that. Why? The answer is mirror neurons. So mirror neurons are the architecture inside your brain that allows you to essentially imagine and put yourself in the other guy's shoes. Okay, so that's the only reason why a movie makes any sense, or somebody singing a song about their lost love, you know, it's like they, you can feel what they are feeling by the expressions that they're having. And so when I think of myself, who's, I'm a straight guy, so I don't want to see two males kissing. Bugs the shit out of me. Okay. Interestingly enough, when Brokeback Mountain came out, I had women coming to me saying, oh, they liked it. They really liked it. And I like, tell me about that. Oh, no, I have no interest. Oh, you should see it, Dr. Light. No, I have no interest in seeing this. Okay. Why? Oh, you're homophobic. I'm not homophobic. Well, whatever you want to call it. The truth of the matter is, these are disgust reactions. Okay, what you're looking at is, if I put myself in that other male's place, in other words, and that I'm going to be having sex with another male, my immediate reaction is, I have absolutely no interest being here. I'm designed by nature to be highly selective about my mating behavior. Certainly I rule out 100% of all males. And then I rule out a significant percentage of all females. In other words, I'm designed by nature to be picky, for God's sakes. Okay, so therefore, in a mirror neuron situation, I don't want to see two unattractive people making out. If I do, I like turn my head away. Okay, you almost never see it. But the truth is, if you did, or if some woke, you know, movie producer needed to put that on film somewhere, it's like, really? This is what you're going to show me? This is why I shelled out my $13 and bought my milk duds and didn't tell Alan? Okay? That's what I'm here to do, is to watch that? No, I'm not interested. I don't want to see it. Okay? It's not that I'm, quote, unattractive phobic. I'm not homophobic. You can call it whatever you want. But the truth is, I have mirror neurons, and inside of me, I have preferences. And if those two people are, you know, if there's an attractive guy and he's making out with some attractive woman, I, of course, put myself inside of his brain. Okay? And that makes me, I'm essentially, my mirror neurons are, I am making out with her. And that's fine. I'm completely fine with that. Okay? So that's what I think, that this is the, you have a disgust reactions to tell you when you are doing things that are evolutionarily expensive. That's what it is. You're about to bite into some food and you chew it and it's something, there's a terrible scent. Or you open up something in the refrigerator and smell it and it's rotten. And you scrunch up your face in disgust and pull your nose away from it to keep your orifices in your face away from the bacterial contamination that could make you sick. Okay? That is the same type of reaction we have to watching people do sexual activities that to us are for some reason disgusting. In other words, they would be sexual opportunities that we would pass on. Vehemently answer, no, don't do that to yourself. That's not a good thing for us. Okay. That's what it is. Okay. So I think that's all it is. It's, I think the evolution of disgust, there's a guy named Paul Rosen, that for decades and decades has done all kinds of research in this area. And, I think he's a University of Pennsylvania, professor. I'm sure a lot of other people have sort of followed suit. And there's, you know, probably pretty good thinking about this. But that's, I think, what is the fundamental root there. And so you can even listen to me, who I'm perfectly reasonable and I'm certainly middle of the bell curve open. It's like, I'm fine. You know, I can let quite a lot go and I'm pretty live and let live. But don't be sticking things in my face that make me very, you know, that I don't want to look at. And so if I do, I'm not going to tell you to stop because I'm a libertarian, but I will turn my face away and I don't want to see it. Okay. So in the same way, You can imagine people that are less open, less libertarian than I am, you know, writing the canons of the Catholic Church in the last 1,000 years, and they're going to say, don't do it at all. I don't want, you know, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to see it. You shouldn't do it. You know, we're going to write it into the Bible here
Big
about
Louis
this terrible thing.
There.
What's
blame
that?
Big Louis by calling, saying that it's in the scriptures.
That's absolutely priceless, Nathan. Yeah, that is the ultimate blame Big Louis right there. Hey, Big Louis says you guys can't do that. You know, that's it. Going to turn you all into stone or whatever it is. Okay, so yeah, I think though the root of the problem is the disgust reaction and mirror neurons. You put those two things together, and that's how you get homophobia. Mm. Yeah, I think that's pretty well it. I think that the Jen would weigh in and essentially she would probably, I'm not going to put words in her mouth, but there's the females, I think in general are not as disgusted for some reason. In the same way, well, like for example, I think females looking at two gay men would be not dissimilar to a male's looking at two females. It's like, hey, if I put myself in either one of them's shoes, I'm fine. Okay, so I think a lot of women, on average, are probably less disgusted and upset by male gay behavior because to them, it's like, hey, what's the problem? The guys are attractive enough, you know. It's not really bothering me to put myself in either one of them's mind and to be making out with the other one. Doesn't bother me. So, but it's interesting that put a female in her imagination looking at two females. I don't think there's the same disgust level of reaction as it is with males. So I'm not sure why that is. And like I said, some great evolutionary theorists may have identified that that's true and then may have some perfectly reasonable reason for why that would be true. I don't know. You've reached the limits of my speculation in this area.
Wonderful. Well, that's a great place to end, though, Dr. Lyle. So thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And maybe when Jen decides to come back, hopefully we wish her all the best with her dogs. Hopefully they're okay.
Sure.
But yeah, if she decides to mosey on back, maybe I might ask her about this question.
She'll come back, but whether or not she listens to us on this is questionable. She probably will. And then she'll probably be cringing and then have to clean up the podcast and, you know, get us sailing right. But I think I haven't done too badly, and hopefully the boss won't penalize both of us. At least you get to skate, Nathan. There you go.
Well, I have the all mute right. button, so, you know, and the edit button, so I get it. No, Dr. Lyle, we love you. So we really appreciate you coming on, and thank you so much for your insight and for your wisdom.
All good. Very good, Nathan, and we'll see you all soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G, Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.